Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Last Wednesday, Army Specialist Ivan Antonio Lopez opened fire with a .45 caliber handgun at Fort Hood. He killed three fellow soldiers, injured 16, and then killed himself. Again, we ask, how can the military identify soldiers who are at high risk of violence? And how do we answer the question of who should be restricted to access to guns? Lopez had mental health issues. He had been prescribed medications and was being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. It's unclear whether or not he had shown enough distress to worry his doctors or his commanders. This hour of the program, we will eventually have two guests with us, a reporter for KUT in Austin who's been covering this story since last week. Drake Logan is joining us right now. Drake is a community organizer for the Civilian Soldier Alliance. It works with veterans and active duty service members to build a GI resistance movement toward a just foreign policy. She is the author of a forthcoming report on Fort Hood policies, which was done in conjunction with the Under the Hood Cafe and Outreach Center, a community space for soldiers and veterans. And she has spent several months in Fort Hood over the last 2 years examining the conditions there. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Always for you to reach us. Drake, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon. Hi, Drake. Are you there?
Yes,
there
thanks
we go.
For having me.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. You were quoted as saying that, of course, this is an obviously heartbreaking and enraging story, but given all we know, and particularly you know with your work about mental health issues and physical health issues, you say that they are pretty actively ignored, neglected, stigmatized, and punished on our military bases?
Absolutely. We've been working, as you noted, at Fort Hood for around 3 years and conducting our testimony project from which this report is emerging later this year from 2012 to 2013 and collected 31 formal testimonies along with having over 1,000 outreach conversations on base at Fort Hood. And yes, like you said, unfortunately, what we find is that increasingly, in fact, both physical and mental health issues at Fort Hood are being stigmatized, punished, and people are being disciplinary discharged for anything from being a pound overweight to being late for too many formations to lots of things that can really stem from their traumatic injuries, which in many cases are from their experiences on deployments in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So unfortunately, there's a whole host of systemic issues that are really at fault here for a lot of what's going on at Fort Hood and beyond.
And Drake, what are the soldiers saying about the effects of those many deployments in Iraq or Afghanistan or both?
Well, really, each deployment that people go on, we heard from soldiers and veterans at Fort Hood that it really compounds the trauma that people go through. So the likelihood of coming home with a traumatic injury like PTSD, traumatic brain injury, or military sexual trauma compounds with each deployment. And, you know, people said that generally it's when you know that you're going to go back to a next deployment after coming home, it makes it near impossible to try to adjust in between those deployments. So many people just regarded that time between deployments as kind of they were on pause, you know, and just waiting to go back and do their job again. Unfortunately, that has, you know, particularly rough mental health consequences when you don't actually take a break and start to feel safe between, you know, your experiences in wartime deployments. And on top of that, Fort Hood really wasn't tracking people who came back with traumatic injuries or even physical injuries to the extent that they really should have. So pre- and post-deployment screening processes at Fort Hood, we found across the board, were reported as cursory, biased, and in some cases corrupt.
Corrupt? How so?
Well, it's, again, very unfortunate and sad that during the course, especially while the war in Iraq was going on alongside the war in Afghanistan, what we saw was that oftentimes if commanders and first-line supervisors of units at Fort Hood, if they needed the numbers of people to deploy, they could simply put in a call or ask for someone at the deployment screening process, which is called SRP, to just waive the person or not see, have a medical professional not even see them before they deployed. So there were many ways we found that commanders could basically make it so that a soldier didn't even have to be screened for injuries before they were deployed.
Well, there were so many troubling things about what happened last week, but the commander at Fort Hood was quoted in the papers as saying that the military had evidence that the soldier Lopez had an unstable psychiatric or psychological condition that might have been an underlying cause of the shooting. Well, goodness, for somebody to say something like that, you would hope that this person was getting some kind of substantial treatment, and secondly, that that person would not have been able to go into a store and get a gun.
Yeah, from what we know, Ivan Lopez had deployed twice, once to Iraq and also before the Iraq war started, had deployed to Egypt. But, you know, it's not really came out yet exactly whether he had been diagnosed with a particular disorder or not. But, you know, regardless, lots of soldiers and veterans around Fort Hood are going through, you know, really devastating experiences of living with trauma without adequate care. And we found, in many cases, people going through these traumatic injuries without treatment during active duty are also just encountering a really severe culture of stigma at Fort Hood that discourages them from even stepping forward to seek care. Then there's a host of barriers once you, you know, even get the courage up to step into the door and seek care. The Army during the drawdown is increasingly just punishing and discharging soldiers instead of giving them access to adequate treatment. I don't want to start to ramble here, but, you know, it seems that Lopez couldn't even reach the treatment resources that he needed, let alone get to, you know, adequate support for whatever he was going through, which is an all too common experience at Fort Hood right now.
Well, isn't that remarkable that that would be the case, because there was another shooting in 2009 at the same base? You would think that all kinds of procedures would have been put in place to keep this from ever happening again.
Well, I have heard from veterans who have been at Fort Hood for a number of years that the base did, you know, tighten down on security a bit after the 2009 shooting. But really, I think what's more at issue here is that people are going through long histories now, over a decade of, for some people, of being deployed multiple times to Iraq and Afghanistan, right, and not being treated for those issues, which, you know, over time compounds. And the administration at Fort Hood actually has had policies on the books which they have been in many ways choosing to ignore that could certainly help these issues, you know, get better over time. But what's lacking in the policies that are upholding soldier care and, you know, supposed to be fighting the stigma amongst leadership really have no accountability or enforcement mechanisms. They're left teethless. The military can talk all day about how they are implementing policies that uphold soldier care and are proactive about traumatic injuries, but without anything to make sure that those policies are enforced within the chain of command at any level, everything goes unchecked.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, you've gathered all this testimony from soldiers, most of whom have been deployed, I'm sure, more than once. What will you do with the testimony?
So we've been preparing a very extensive report for over a year now from the 31 formal testimonies that we collected at Fort Hood. And we'll be releasing a report on Memorial Day this year on May 26th. It will largely include narrative versions of those testimonies because we feel that it's very important to let soldiers and veterans speak for themselves. They tend to be people in the public discourse that are used in all kinds of ways that are instrumentalized for this or that public, for this or that politic. But we really want those stories to stand as a kind of people's history of what's gone on in the military during these wars and occupations. So we'll also have an extensive set of recommendations that accompany those testimonies along with our own findings. So that will be released this Memorial Day, and we'll, of course, be doing advocacy around the release of that report and beyond.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Drake, and we'll take them momentarily. Drake Logan is with the Civilian Soldier Alliance. It works with veterans and active duty service members to build a GI resistance movement toward a just foreign policy. She's author, you heard her describe in great detail, of a forthcoming report on Fort Hood policies that was done in conjunction with Under the Hood Cafe and Outreach Center, a community space for soldiers and veterans. And she has spent a good portion of the last couple months, she wasn't there the day of the shooting, but she spent a good portion of the last couple months in Fort Hood gathering testimony from soldiers. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, where you can reach us at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for our guest, and we start with Rocky in Neshkoro. Hi, Rocky.
Hi. Yeah, this is Rocky.
Hi, Rocky. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
I was just wondering, you know, from what I understand, this last shooter was diagnosed with problems and then still was allowed to pass the federal registration process. Part of that is, to my understanding, is they don't get any information from doctors as far as the unfitness of an individual. Couldn't we hold those doctors accountable for their not reporting this?
What do you know about that process from your interviews with all these people at Fort Hood? Would it be normal to report to authorities who would then put you on some kind of list that you shouldn't be able to purchase a weapon? I mean, Rocky makes an interesting point here, and an important one.
There's several factors at stake here, and one is that, you know, and it goes back to the issue of these multiple deployments and then also back to the nature of military training, which is partly that when people come back, after they've received this training and gone through deployments where many of them fight in combat, they're not untrained of their, you know, their military training to essentially to fight, you know, when they get into an argument or when they get into an altercation, which is compounded, of course, by going through, you know, traumatic experiences. So, again, I don't know exactly what it was going on with the, Ivan Lopez, but certainly, you know, there is an issue with medical and mental health providers at Fort Hood being held accountable for their oversight of soldiers. But what I would like to emphasize even more so is that one of the root problems here is that commanders with no medical or mental health training at Fort Hood maintain total discretion over soldiers' medical care. And that's actually in violation of Fort Hood's own command policies, which say that commanders need to be respecting doctors' orders as orders and not only as recommendations, right? So we found across the board at Fort Hood that this policy that Fort Hood has upholding doctors' orders is regularly disregarded, that doctors' orders are regularly overrided or simply ignored so that commanders can effectively force soldiers to work in ways that are medically against doctors' recommendations, which, of course, exacerbates their condition, both mental and physical.
Why would they do that?
Well, there's a long history in the military, not just in the Army at Fort Hood, but of military medicine being focused on combat readiness and returning people to duty as soon as possible. And in part, you know, that's the mandate of the military. But, you know, what we've found is, of course, you know, obviously that really exacerbates people's long-term prognosis, especially when it's in a context where the military is trying to hold down two fairly massive occupations, you know, in foreign theaters at the same time and has a relatively small fighting force. So it's partly allowed because the military does not have to abide by civilian codes of medical ethics. And that's, you know, not, you know, by the books, it really should, and it says that it does. But in practice, we've found that it doesn't.
Thank you, Rocky, very much for your call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Rich. To the guest. I was at the inaugural event of the Soldier's Heart Movement. Ed Tick had written a book called War and the Soul, and he and his partner, Kate Dahlstad, some years back established the Soldier's Heart Movement, and they started out in Wheaton, Illinois. And I have a memory from that of a mother of a son who was serving in Afghanistan who was very concerned because she said, my son is communicating with me, writing to me, texting me that he's being given pills that make it impossible for him to sleep at night. I stayed for the whole set of workshops, and I heard many soldiers talk about the fact that when they go to the VA for mental health issues, they're treated pharmaceutically. That is, they joke about being given pills for depression, for anxiety, and basically treated in a very dismissive way in terms of the profound kinds of experiences they have had soldiering. And I know it's called the Defense Department, and I don't want to offend anybody, but it seems to me we're living with a war machine that is rolling over our young people and not doing them justice when they return to our shores.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. Drake.
Yes, the issue of medical providers providing almost exclusively prescription drug treatment for people's ailments, both physical and mental health-wise, is a huge problem. And it's gotten a good amount of reporting in terms of the VA side of things. But we've found that really those issues with prescribing as the sole solution and, in fact, over-prescribing, including medications that are addictive, really starts on the active duty side, and it's what's gotten people through multiple deployments in many cases, that instead of the military, while people are active duty, treating them with other than prescription drug options, they're given prescriptions, they're sent back to duty. It's a kind of Band-Aid that, you know, in the end is causing people many more problems because in terms of being prescribed certain pain medications, people get addicted. They then need to, you know, address that issue. In other cases, you know, it's just allowing the underlying medical or mental health condition to be exacerbated while the Band-Aid is on the wound, and they go through yet more traumatic experiences, either at war or here at home, in the course of their military service. So over-prescription is a huge issue. And again, it's an issue that, isn't within the realm of ethical medical or mental health practice to be doing things like what we see at Fort Hood, where soldiers are not given diagnoses, but they're given the medication. That's not part of the usual ethical, medical practice that we would like to see and that we see in the civilian world.
Mm. You spent probably 2 months of the last year at Fort Hood. When you first heard those news reports come in, what were you thinking about? Was it a shock to you, or did you see something like this as a possibility? I'm just wondering. It would probably shake me to the core if I had spent 2 months there.
Yeah, it's absolutely devastating to hear about another shooting. It's heartbreaking, like I've said.
Mm-hmm.
What was going through my mind was honestly what's been going through my mind for the last 2 years, which is that there are thousands of soldiers both at Fort Hood and at many other bases in the U.S. that are simply having to suffer through their lives without adequate treatment and without the military or the VA taking accountability for what's been done to their soldiers. Who's really shouldering the burden is their families, is their communities, are the people in proximity to them who are hurt when things like this happen, who are acting as the informal, unpaid, unacknowledged support system for soldiers and veterans who have really been used up by the military multiple times in these deployments and then just discarded. It's incredibly sad.
It is sad. Thank you very much, Rich, for your call. We have a lines open if you want to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. Drake Logan is our guest, community organizer with the Civilian Soldier Alliance. She spent about 2 months of last year at Fort Hood interviewing soldiers, and their testimony will be presented on Memorial Day, talking about the conditions, the physical health conditions, the mental health conditions, how the Army may fail in its mission to keep soldiers healthy in all ways. So we have one line open now if you'd like to join us. John in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, John.
Hi, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a psychologist and have worked with many veterans over the years, and what I've noticed, which is just really appalling to me, one observation on the front end with people going in is that I work with a lot of young people, and they are wanting to get into the military, but if they've received any counseling or therapy, and particularly if they're in any psychotropic meds, the recruiters very, very actively discourage them from reporting any of that, because that will disqualify them. So ultimately what winds up happening in many instances, those young people get into the service, and then the bottom falls out. So you can't really be honest on the front end about your situation and have it be recognized and simply treated as you go along. You've got to lie about it to get in. And then on the way out, what I've observed is that what a previous caller was saying, the vast, vast majority of patients that come to me are people that have already gone to the VA, but they've only been treated solely with psychotropic meds. And there's no therapy involved. There's no sense of, somebody gives a damn about me and is willing to sit down and spend any time with me. Instead, what tends to happen is that the VA comes up with protocols that are meant to, quote, cure people with PTSD in X number of sessions, say 20, 10 or 15 sessions. And, the professional psychology and psychiatry generally, knows that that's a bunch of nonsense. But I think so much of this is propagated because we have to, as a culture, make it appear as if, you can send young people off to do these jobs and maybe something will happen, maybe it won't, but if it does, you know, we can take care of it. It's not so simple.
No, I'm sure it's not. So when you think of an ideal therapy for returning vets, particularly those who have served more than one deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan, what does it involve? Long-term talking therapy, John?
Well, in many instances, it does involve psychotropic meds. Mm-hmm. And in the vast majority of instances, it should also involve therapy, talking therapy, being able to have the patients to listen to people's experiences and to validate their experiences and to help them find avenues to move their life forward despite what they've been through. But all that takes time. And I think what we don't want to acknowledge culturally is that there's no quick fix for these things.
Mm-hmm. Drake, what do you think?
I agree that there's no quick fix and that it's also incredibly degrading to say to a veteran, to have these systems say to veterans and active duty soldiers, you know, this should just be something we can fix overnight. I work very closely in my organization, Civilian Soldier Alliance, works very closely with Iraq Veterans Against the War. And, you know, we've found, you know, that veterans in IVAW find it really healing to start organizing on these issues, to go from people who have been, you know, ones that have struggled to survive through these experiences in the military and as veterans, and actually become active participants in movements that are seeking to change how the military can use and abuse people and how the VA can ignore them and how, you know, the military can commit to wars that it can't, you know, commit to taking care of people afterwards. So it's partly, you know, healing for people to be part of the solution for this.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John, for your call. Bob in Baraboo is next. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'll make it real quick. I was active duty 26 years, 11B, 76 Yankee, 11 Charlie, all combat MOSs. Nobody in that guy's chain of command has stepped forward and said, hey, you know, we knew there's something wrong with this kid. That's why we let him transfer MOSs and posts. That just isn't done. You might switch from an 11B slot to 11 Charlie slot, something like that in the combat MOSs, but they were worried about this kid and moved him into a truck driving slot. Simple as that.
Hmm. What should they have done?
I'm sorry?
What should they have done, Bob?
Well, you know, these kids you get in the Army, a cross-section of the population.
Sure.
You know, are you going to have some goofy ones sneak through? It's just the way it is. But when you transfer MOSs, military operating specialties, from combat arms to a truck driver, in my 26 years, I never seen anything like that.
Hmm.
I seen guys go into Pathfinder slots, 76 Yankee. I seen them go into Charlie slots, mortar, maybe even artillery.
Uh-huh.
They wanted this kid away from combat arm stuff and in a truck driver slot.
Uh-huh.
Simple as that.
Uh-huh.
Somebody down the chain of command, his last platoon sergeant before he left Fort Bliss, knew something's wrong with that kid.
Uh-huh.
Now, they didn't know, you know, he was going to do something crazy, but they had him worried enough to let him do that.
Drake, what do you think?
Well, what we found at Fort Hood is really that one of the options for what to do when people are going through, when soldiers are going through, you know, traumatic experiences and severe injuries is that people can be medically retired, which is the Medical Evaluation Board or MEB process in the Army. And, you know, that's supposed to be a process by which a soldier can be evaluated for their medical or mental health conditions. They can receive treatment while they're being evaluated. They can have certain work restrictions that will that will make it so that they're not re-traumatized or re-injured. It's set up to be a way that they can transition out of the military without having their condition worsen, and through that process evaluate how disabled they are, how much of a disability percentage they should receive upon their discharge. And essentially the Army would be acknowledging you are this percentage disabled and unable to work, therefore we'll fund you until you can get into the VA system for what you need. So that's the way it generally is supposed to work, is set up on paper to work. But we found that since the drawdown in forces started after the Iraq War ended, and the military is drawing down its ranks, that the MEB process is incredibly bogged down with injured soldiers, and it's causing unnecessary delays for disabled soldiers getting access to medical treatment. They're having to wait for months and sometimes years to see the providers that they need, and in that time, what we're finding increasingly is that soldiers are, instead of being given that treatment and that disability percentage, they're being given what are called Article 15s, which are disciplinary measures, which add up to sometimes what's called a pattern of misconduct. And these are things that, like, often are part of what they're going through because of their injuries, that they can't always wake up as early as they need to for formation, that they can't work 24-hour duty days, but instead those effects are being punished as bad conduct, and they're being given bad conduct or other than honorable discharges, which do not give them benefits.
Why is it that we, for years now, don't seem to be able to get this right? I mean, there was this big scandal at Walter Reed a few years ago with everybody highlighting the horrendous conditions and the long waits, and I thought that we paid some attention to that issue. It sounds like we haven't.
Well, I think some attention, obviously has been paid. These issues are on the national radar a lot more than they certainly used to be while these wars were both going on. However, a huge part of what hasn't changed is that there have been no policy changes systematically within the military on the active duty side that would hold up doctors' orders so that commanders and first-line supervisors are still able to run rampant over doctors' orders for how soldiers should be taken care of. That then creates that is part of sort of a hidden factor of the burden on VA health structures, is the lack of care and lack of anything other than prescription drug treatment within active duty basically pours veterans onto the VA who have had very little health care coverage, health care treatment during their service, and have been given all these drugs and then discharged without adequate even record keeping of their injuries. As well, of course, the VA just doesn't have the resources either that it still needs to be able to treat people. So, we saw just recently the 2015 budget come out for discretionary spending on the military, and we see a lot going to Department of Defense and, a decent amount going to Veterans Affairs. But we're still, one of the callers mentioned, we're still spending, we're apportioning much more money toward fighting the next wars that aren't even, public discourse yet than we are on healing the veterans who have been used up in fighting past wars.
Thank you, Bob, so much for your call. Jay in Menominee, Michigan. Hello. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jay.
My comment is, I'm a 14-year veteran. I spent two tours in Iraq, and I got out after 14 years and started making it a career because there's such a stigma in the United States Army for service period, and it starts higher up in the chain of command, that the moment you seek help for PTSD or anything like that, they want to label you Section 8. And, a soldier, if you let them seek help outside of the VA, because anybody that's ever dealt with the VA knows that they just shuffle you through and push you off to the side. I sought help with a civilian, and she did a world of good for me. No drugs, just talk therapy, sleep therapy, and it's been 6 years now, and I haven't had a single bad thought, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And we just need to get rid of the stigma that seeking help is not a bad thing.
And why do you think it's so strong? Why is that stigma around? Why?
It started back in, I guess you'd call it the Iron Days, back in World War One and World War Two, where, you know, you just pick up, move on, you know, get a quick stitch, get a slap on the back and get back out in the field, and it's still that way today.
Mm-hmm. Drake.
We actually asked that question to, we posed that question to all of the Fort Hood soldiers and veterans who we interviewed, you know, where do you think this stigma comes from? Because everyone said unequivocally that the stigma for any admission of vulnerability or injury, physically or mentally, was heavily stigmatized at Fort Hood and at other bases that they'd been at through in the country. And people said many different things. A lot of people did say what Jay just said, which is that, you know, it goes very high up in the leadership. This is something that that commanders and first-line supervisors and often people's NCOs in their unit are perpetuating. It's something that young recruits are trained into as soon as they step foot into the realm of the military. So it's passed around on multiple levels. But an interesting thing that we did find in our conversations was that a lot of people said, you know, the stigma depends totally on the unit that you're in. Who is your NCO? Who is their supervisor? Mm-hmm. Whether they are perpetuating that stigma or not. And that's actually really unfortunate because a lot of units are still going through the experience of having leadership that perpetuates that stigma, that punishes injuries, basically. And that is in total violation of Fort Hood's own command policy, which and it's called Surge 01, and it says that all levels of leadership should actively work against the stigmatization of physical injuries and mental injuries or seeking help in any way for those injuries. So that is an everyday issue of commanders, of supervisors at Fort Hood going against the policy on record.
Mm-hmm. Jay, I'm glad you're feeling well.
What's that?
I said I'm glad you're feeling well.
Oh, thank you. My wife was the one that pushed me.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at KDunnShow. We're talking about last week's horrendous shooting at Fort Hood and talking with Drake Logan. Drake is a community organizer with the Civilian Soldier Alliance, and she spent a number of days during the course of the last year getting testimony on redeployment, on post-traumatic stress, on how the medical and physical facilities may be not quite sufficient for the soldiers' needs at Fort Hood and on other military bases as well. So she is with us this hour. Two more of your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Pat in Appleton. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for a great show. This may sound like a dumb question, but, you know, in human medicine, when there's great trauma, you know, there's debriefing of the team. And I wonder, is there any sort of protocol that soldiers get, you know, every so many months, a of debriefing? Is there a protocol in place for anything like that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Pat.
So that's a great question because I know just from speaking to many people in crisis intervention and other clinical positions that debriefing can be critical in terms of someone's long-term and even immediate-term prognosis with trauma. There are certain kinds of debriefing that soldiers may sometimes go through after a particular event that could be traumatic while they're on deployment. But in terms of sort of periodic, regular briefings or debriefings, we didn't hear about those happening at Fort Hood. What do happen are a set of regular trainings that people go through, on various issues of traumatic injuries, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma. Unfortunately, what we heard from soldiers and veterans of Fort Hood is that those trainings are often, discouraging in terms of what they actually contain. Often they're given in a PowerPoint presentation that is not terribly engaging, that is cut to around 20 minutes in a long training day, sort of set up to not, give people the kind of critical information that they need in an engaging way. And especially in terms of even more sensitive issues like military sexual trauma, which we know from all kinds of reporting is a huge issue in the military, we heard from soldiers at Fort Hood that those trainings are often basically taken as a joke, that the trainers aren't equipped to be handling the seriousness of the issues. And this also goes for other kinds of trauma like PTSD that, they're being given by people, the trainings are being given by people in the chain of command that don't have in-depth training on the issues, that don't have mental health training, that are rolling through a set of PowerPoints. And, it ends up, from a leadership standpoint, it ends up communicating that those issues actually aren't important, but rather they should be stigmatized because we're not going to, present a training that actually can hold the depth and the seriousness of those issues, unfortunately.
Margaret in Green Bay, hello.
Hi. I wanted to share the name of a psychologist that I have been to. His name is Dr. Alan Botkin, and he's developed his career to helping veterans with PTSD and or PTSD. Right now there's a documentary being made about his work. It's that you can see a trailer at www.healingafterthewar.org. And I can attest to his successes because I'm a parent who witnessed my child's violent death. And after months and months of talk therapy and medicines and different things, I was able to visit him for two sessions and have a remarkable turnaround in my grief. And I just feel like this type of therapy needs to be made available to every single veteran.
Are you familiar with the therapy, Drake?
I'm not familiar with that particular therapy modality, but I do appreciate hearing about it, and I'm very glad to hear, Margaret, that was so instrumental in your process of healing. In terms of what does help veterans, at least that I've met and that I've worked with, especially at Under the Hood Cafe there in Killeen and also in Iraq Veterans Against the War, like I mentioned, a lot of different treatments and are helpful for people, as well as things like writing, doing art, being able to express one's experience. But again, and I know I touched on this before, but just briefly, what people have been able to gather around as organizers in IVAW is really becoming active around these issues oneself, taking what used to be a dehumanizing context in the military and what that does to people, and trying to work toward a systemic change that can mean that that doesn't have to happen to more people after one serves. And as well, you know, people in IBAW are working toward actual reparations with people in Iraq that have endured the effects of these wars as well, and trying to work for U.S. government accountability after the wars, which, you know, is something that I think can help people heal and also, you know, help the sense of guilt and heavy responsibility that a lot of veterans feel for what has gone on in Iraq and Afghanistan during these wars.
I'm glad you've been helped, Margaret.
Thank you.
It's been hard. That's an understatement for you, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah. Thank you very
thanks,
much.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Helen, Menominee Falls. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I hope this is helpful. My daughter is married into the military, and she has mild asthma and hay fever. But over the last 8 years, she has just been so over-medicated and going to doctors, twice ended up in the ICU. We didn't know if she was going to live or die. And at one point, she was on 27 different medications, prescription medications. And we always thought, you'll get off of everything. Let us take you to Mayo Clinic. Let us do something. But couldn't do it. And, you know, if there's some way that these people that prescribe all this stuff could get more training and other avenues of treatment other than pills.
Hmm. So she got all this by living on a base.
Yes.
Drake.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm very sorry to hear that your daughter has been going through that. And similarly, we spoke to many families at Fort Hood who, because of their health coverage, their military health coverage, are seeing similar providers in the military healthcare structures and under that insurance, and encountering some of the same problems themselves. So I would say that, unfortunately, that's a wider experience that your daughter has gone through. One of the important things that our research points to in terms of, you know, what can we recommend for the military to do? How can they overcome some of these issues? One thing is certainly that people who are under military health care coverage and insurance plans need to be able to access civilian providers with a much greater accessibility. It's very hard for people, as it stands right now, who are under those insurance plans to actually get referrals. It's hard enough that for them to actually see a qualified doctor, but in order for them to get to the point where the military will refer them out is very difficult. That process needs to be streamlined. It needs to be readily available that people can go outside of the military. And then there needs to be some way that those civilian providers can be can have their records synced up with the military healthcare providers, so that people aren't having to deal with, you know, really an inordinate amount of record keeping on their own. And then another important recommendation is that there needs to be some form of patient advocacy going on in these healthcare structures. They're just gargantuan bureaucracies that, of course, we've heard have very long wait times, very difficult processes of referrals, et cetera, and there are no advocates for people. So we really need to have implemented a direct resource for that.
Thank you so much. We have less than a minute left, but let's get to Rob quickly in Sauk County. Hi, Rob.
Yeah, hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Listen, all that I wanted to quick say is about Fort Hood. Every time I went overseas, well, I was at a lot of bases, but every time I came back, twice I was at Fort Hood, 2 years stationed, once 14 months and the other 10 months or so. And it's different. When you come out of there, Fort Hood is totally different. It's like they don't go with the rules. They want you to get back, right back on the horse again. Like, they don't care where you've been. They don't care if you've been overseas and had combat. They don't look at that stuff. And if you go in and see a doctor and stuff, and if you think you have problems and stuff, and back in my day it was called shell shock or something. Tough up, boy. Get back out there, you know, do your duty. I was surprised when I heard that one gentleman say, yeah, they just put him in trucking duty. Well, you know, we and these kids today, I don't know. I had so much to say before, but I'm telling you, Fort Hood is totally different.
Thank you so much. I would wish we could hear more of your stories, but we're out of time. Thank you, Rob. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and for on-air production, Drake Logan from the Civilian Soldier Alliance. Thank you for being with us. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 1 until 3. Thanks for listening.